there isn't going to be another round of chemotherapy. There isn't another biopsy to do. And what do we have to offer in those moments as healers? I think what we have to offer is our hearts, our souls, the human connection that's possible through bearing witness as poetry does.
Coming up on In Contrast, Medicine and Poetry with Rafael Campo. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Dr. Rafael Campo is a poet, essayist, and physician. Campo practices internal medicine at Harvard Medical School and at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. His medical practice primarily serves Latinos and gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. As a poet, Campo is the recipient of numerous awards and honors, including a Guggenheim Fellowship and a National Poetry Series Award. Rafael Campo, it's a pleasure having you on In Contrast. Thank you for coming. I want to start with these two sides, these two identities that you have, the one of the physician and the poet. How do they relate to one another? Do you compartmentalize? Is this the time in terms of your schedule where you devote yourself to writing poetry and you don't think about your patients? Or are you thinking about what you're going to write while you are with your patients? This is something that shows up in your poems, but I'd love to hear you articulate your ideas on it.
Sure. My work with patients really is a form of poetry. I find that when I'm engaged in talking about a patient's history, when patients are telling me in this incredibly metaphoric language about what the symptom feels like, particularly my Latino patients who tend to speak even more colorfully in metaphoric language, when I am listening to the patient's heart through my stethoscope, these are all ways in which I think poetry is manifest in my relationship with my patients, in my very encounter with patients in my examining room. And so to me, they've always felt inextricably interrelated, that they are of a piece. The two things that I do are really one. And I feel often that I'm writing a poem in the office, in the clinic setting. And many of my poems actually have that specific context acknowledged quite literally in the poems. But I think that even in this larger sense, the work of healing really is, I think, deeply engaged with poetry. Because you know, I've also found in my many years now of doing both of these things that in biomedicine, we sometimes have an answer. We sometimes have a cure. We sometimes have another treatment to offer. But very often we don't. And ultimately, in almost every case I can imagine, there isn't going to be another round of chemotherapy. There isn't another biopsy to do. What do we have to offer in those moments as healers? I think what we have to offer is our hearts, our souls, the human connection that's possible through bearing witness as poetry does.
When you say that the poetry is in the actual visit that you have with the patients, are you saying that it's the language with which they describe the symptoms, the ailments? Are you saying also that the entire scene is poetic?
Yes, I think both, actually, Ilan. That's also a wonderful question. I find that the language itself, the presence, the empathetic connection that forms during those interactions is certainly part of the poetry, and I think probably the most profound part of the interaction that I have with someone who is suffering. So yes, the language they use to describe what they're feeling, the way in which the pain feels like a cold wind blowing through the liver or through the hole in my chest, you know, these are ways of expressing what perhaps in some ways is inexpressible, is unspeakable. And poetry famously does that. Poetry speaks the unspeakable, right?
The fact that as a physician that you notice or you are influenced and inspired by the very circumstance in which you work, and that scene might result in a poem, is there an intrusion of privacy or even of confidentiality with the patient? I'm thinking here as a teacher that I might want to tell my students at the very beginning that I am writing a diary or that it might end up becoming a book so that people are aware of this. Do you feel the responsibility when something becomes a poem of letting whoever was in front of you know that that was the result of the encounter?
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely, Alan. And this relates a little bit to what I was going to say in response to your previous question as well, that yes, the space itself is a constrained space. The clinical space is a narrow room with a very small window and an exam table. And so the data of the space itself suggests compression, suggests limits, suggests what can and cannot be said in that space. And so, yes, I'm always very cognizant of the kinds of limitations to what I might make in terms of art out of these encounters. And I would say further that the narrative in these spaces, the story that is shared in these moments, is really, again, a shared story. So I feel very much my own stake in the telling, and that even as my patient relates her pain, her suffering, that I'm a participant in that story. I'm a witness to that experience, and that in some ways I am called to tell that story, particularly if the voice I'm hearing is one that is marginalized in our society, in our larger culture. And I take care of many patients in my clinic who, in a real sense, don't have a voice in our culture, who are marginalized, who don't have access to the best medical care. They don't have insurance. And I'm their way into the system, in a sense. And so I feel a kind of obligation, actually, at times, not to monumentalize, not to sugarcoat, not to prettify the experiences that they share with me, but really as a kind of, again, really a witness and as a member of community. I'm a primary care doctor. I'm part of the community in which I work. So I think it's really, again, a kind of responsibility I have to share these narratives. And then, yes, if I do speak to a particular person's story, I think, yes, it is important to acknowledge in creating that poem that this is a collaboration, really, that this poem doesn't belong just to me. This is not about me, the doctor in the white coat, aggrandizing myself and saying, you know, I have this platform, I have an MD, I have the degree, I have the authority and the power to tell this story, but rather, how can I be a kind of conduit or a vehicle for sharing this story that really is a story about us as engaged in a therapeutic alliance, a therapeutic relationship?
You have used at least once, maybe on a couple of occasions in this conversation, the word healer to describe the doctor. In my mind, the word resonates with maybe a shaman or a community leader. And maybe one of the critiques that some of us who are not inside the medical profession is that the healer side of the doctor is absent, that they are robots that come and look at us as matter to be diagnosed and then they disappeared. Is this a word that you're close to?
Yes, yes. I think, unfortunately, the biomedical model, which has been so successful in many ways and has advanced our knowledge about pathophysiology and diagnosis and treatment of dread diseases, unfortunately, at times has made those kinds of advances, I think, at the cost of seeing the human suffering that accompanies them and really also acknowledging that human cost and being attentive and engaged in healing in that larger sense, the suffering that patients experience. And so my experience definitely is one of wanting, yes, of course, always to deliver the most up-to-date and data-driven science and technology to help cure my patients if possible, to help alleviate their symptoms. But I think part of healing them, part of really being a curandero, being a shaman, being a healer in this broad sense, is also comforting them and joining with them in their journey of illness. I often think of the experience I've had in the hospital where there are multiple machines and all these technologies surrounding the patient's bed, spewing all this data that is determining our decisions about IV fluids and medications and all those important biomedical decisions. But sometimes I feel what's most important is wading through all those machines and just getting to the patient and getting next to that patient and warming her hand and saying and speaking, I'm here to help you, to be present with you. And that sometimes is, in my experience again, perhaps in some ways even more valuable than some of the biomedical treatments we offer.
You said that writing poetry, connection with being a doctor, is bearing witness in being empathetic to the patient. Is it also therapeutic for you to leave that space of surgery and intervention and decay and go to a space where you can reflect on this and maybe heal yourself?
Another wonderful question. I think in some ways, you know, doctors are very practiced in distancing. And in fact, not too long ago in medical education, distancing and a notion of detached concern was really an explicit goal of medical training, that we needed to learn how to get some space, get away from the indelicacies of human suffering. And that was thought to perhaps help us to think more objectively, to think more rationally perhaps about our patients' medical conditions. So yes, I do think that this other kind of distancing or reflection is important, but for a different reason. I think it actually, ironically, perhaps in some sense, brings me closer to the experience of suffering and actually helps to counteract the distancing that was beaten into me during my training, that I wasn't supposed to feel anything about my patients. I certainly wasn't supposed to cry if I saw somebody die in the ICU. I mean, I wasn't supposed to have any kind of emotional relationship to what was going on with my patients. And, you know, I think that kind of distancing, that kind of walling oneself off from the experience of suffering, ironically leads to burnout, leads to, you know, the kind of cynicism and dissatisfaction with medicine that not only many doctors experience now. We're in a moment now where, you know, I hear a lot of my colleagues saying, you know, I would never encourage a young person to go into medicine now. This is a terrible profession. There's so much frustration and a kind of disappointment in medicine. And I think some of it does stem from that kind of callousness, that kind of distancing that many of us in my generation were taught very actively. And so that reflective space is so important for us to renew ourselves and again to feel called again to what I think for many of us was our primary motivation to become physicians, which is to alleviate suffering and to be that person present for our patients.
Are you part of that cohort? If you knew already everything you know about being a doctor right now, would you go again into this profession?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can't imagine the work of being part of community, of being a citizen of this world without being concerned with healing. So yeah, I would become a doctor again in a heartbeat. And I think, again, because it's so joined to my imaginative life and my life as a poet and someone who is concerned about the body and the imagination in the way that a poet is, to my mind, they're just so deeply joined. I find that the meter of the body that I spoke briefly about before, so compelling. I listen to the heartbeat. I listen to the ebb and flow of breathing in my patients' bodies, and that has expression in my poems. And so those two things are deeply, deeply connected for me.
There's something obviously in science and in the medical profession that is very rational, that wants to understand the behavior of the body in clear ways, map it out, predict it, be a step ahead. Is the language of poetry also the language of reason, or is the language of poetry the opposite of reason?
To my mind, that poetry and science have much more in common than they do antagonize one another or are different in their ways of approaching some of these fundamental problems of human existence. When I think about science and I think about pathophysiology and I think about what I learned in medical school, I recognize very clearly the impulse to organize, to categorize, to compartmentalize, to systematize, to make sense of these dark internal processes that for many years we only wish we could elucidate, we only wished we could understand. And so I feel that very strongly in the biomedical way of knowing about disease and about the body. Poetry also has a very deep impulse to organize, to perhaps become a kind of container of emotion, to help us know about the experience of suffering in a way that allows us to be present at it. And again, not to necessarily sugarcoat it or to glamorize it, but actually to make it possible to see it, to not avert our eyes. And, you know, when I think about my own medical training and go back to those moments that were most difficult for me, it wasn't comforting in the same way to know what was causing this patient's stroke, to understand that a clot in the brain was causing ischemia in the neurons that led to their death and led to the deficits I was seeing in the patient's neurological exam. What was comforting to me was to think about how I might be able to give back some of those words through a poem, through the image that I could create together with that person of what was happening to him or to her. And so
this doesn't mean that the poem goes back to that patient in particular, but it comes out of that experience for the rest of us.
Yes, exactly. It speaks perhaps to poetry's capacity for catalyzing empathy within us, that going to the poem, going to this other way of comprehending the experience allowed me to be present at it, to be immersed in it in a way that the biomedical explication of it simply did not. And in fact, in some ways, actually made it feel more alienating and more, again, as you were saying before, Ilan, kind of a problem to be solved rather than an experience that was fundamentally human and couldn't be explicated, but yet could be made sense of, perhaps could be narrated, could be experienced that way.
I have in my mind of the different writers that I know that were also physicians, Chekhov on the one hand, and the other one, William Carlos Williams. And both of them are very different. They are very different in what they want to achieve through theater or short stories or through memoirs and novels and poems. But there is this mutual connection between the empathetic and the being witness to what happens with human nature, that is, that it collapses, and then coming back and writing about it. Not often and not necessarily about the patients themselves, but simply writing about it in a way that has allowed them to see it clearly or more in a raw and direct way. When becoming both a doctor and a poet, did you have any models of people that had combined them that you wanted to pursue or follow?
Yes, well, you mentioned William Carlos Williams, and I would say he was one of my heroes, one of my inspirations. His writing and its immediacy and its courage, really, to bear witness, to be an unflinching kind of observer, but not a distant observer, but an immediate kind of presence in the world that his speaker inhabits was really compelling for me. And he was a primary care doctor. He worked in East Rutherford, New Jersey, in a really impoverished community and made home visits and, again, saw people who were in many respects at the margins up close and was a part of the community in which he worked and was, I think, again, a kind of presence in that community that was, I think, an inspiration for his writing in many respects. Mm-hmm. Although he didn't really ever write much directly about his medical work, I feel it very, very acutely in so many of his stories and poems.
It palpitates underneath, behind
the
words.
It really does, yeah. Absolutely. And I can imagine him writing, you know, some of these poems on prescription pads in his office, you know, in those really brief moments between visits. And, you know, the acuity of those observations, the immediacy of that presence is really striking. And yes, he was certainly one of my inspirations.
Rafael, maybe we can hear you read one of the poems, maybe from Alternative Medicine, one of your collections.
We talked about empathy. You know, my colleagues often say to me, oh, you can't teach empathy. And my response to them frequently is, well, if we can't teach it, perhaps we can enact it. We can make it visible in some sense in modeling it for our learners, for our medical students, our residents, and for our junior colleagues. The title is iatrogenic. Iatrogenic is a term we use in medicine that describes something, typically a treatment or an intervention of some kind that actually causes harm. So this is a poem called Iatrogenic. And to my mind, it is a poem that I hope enacts empathy. Iatrogenic. You say, I do this to myself. Outside, my other patients wait. Maybe snow falls. We're all just waiting for our deaths to come. We're all just hoping it won't hurt too much. You say, it makes it seem less lonely here. I study them as if the deep red cuts were only wounds, as if they didn't hurt so much. The way you hold your upturned arms, the cuts seem aimed at your unshaven face. Outside, my other patients wait their turns. I run gloved fingertips along their course, as if I could touch pain itself, as if by touching pain I might alleviate my own despair. You say, it's snowing, Doc. The snow, instead of howling, soundlessly comes down. I think you think it's beautiful. I say, this isn't all about the snow, is it? The way you hold your upturned arms, I think about embracing you, but don't. I think we do this to ourselves. I think the falling snow explains itself to us, blinding, faceless, and so deeply wounding.
Thank you. That was lovely.
Thank you, Leon.
In your new book, The New and Selected Poems, you react to what you say is an ongoing litany that comes from readers that your writing can be grim, that it can be depressing, that you're dealing with human matter in extreme circumstances. And you seem to be wrestling with it in that essay and in various poems, as if what you're saying to me in this conversation, yes, I want to bear witness, yes, I want to be empathetic, yes, I want to be a curandero, a healer, is also what is bringing you to present an aspect of human nature that people resist, that they want to go to poetry not to think about that, and that feels like a burden. And the way you present it in the book is that this is an aspect that you have been thinking about.
Yes, it's a really difficult paradox, I would say, in some ways, because I do think that we sometimes go to art, we go to poetry to lose ourselves, to not necessarily be troubled by the suffering in our worlds, to, in a sense, in a different way, perhaps, avert our gaze, not in the way the doctor typically does by this right. sort of clinical distancing, but to simply be distracted, perhaps. Or as we were talking about a little bit earlier, to see beauty where there is otherwise pain, to make a monument to our suffering, to aggrandize it in a way that perhaps makes it in some ways more palatable, more honorable, perhaps, that distinguishes us or elevates us in some ways. And so, yes, that impulse to go to art is certainly one I've encountered in my own writing. I'm very much interested in formal structures. And at the same time, I'm still most deeply drawn to the experience of, again, the abject, the unspeakable, the ugly and the horrifying, and not in a prurient way. I think as a doctor, as a healer, I'm called to those situations not to sensationalize them, not necessarily even to monumentalize them or to make art from them, but rather to do something practical with them, to acknowledge that they happen to us and not to look away and to look inside the body and not be disgusted, not be horrified. That's another reason I think poetry in particular is so compelling for me, because it's really helped me to do exactly that, to be in those spaces, to be in those moments and be another human being and join in that experience. And I think that's really absolutely crucial. I think we live in a moment where our fantasies often do delude us. And whether they're political fantasies, whether they are the fantasy that science is going to cure all of us, whether it's the fantasy of art that we can make the ugly somehow more beautiful, that we can narrate away our pain and our suffering, you know, that's problematic for me. And I want to really push back against that in my own work. And at the same time, yes, explore the possibilities of what is beautiful about the ways in which we come to the experience of suffering. And I think there is genuine and authentic kind of beauty, a kind of courage that I've seen in patients who have lived through, who have endured through the kinds of experiences that are just too difficult to imagine.
There is a particular text that has become, it seems to me, from the references that you make to it, a kind of mirror or counter mirror, and that is a book-long essay by Susan Sontag called The Illness as Metaphor, where she ponders the concept of, well, it was written connected with the AIDS epidemic, and she ponders the idea of seeing AIDS as a larger allegory or symbol than what it is, simply the epidemic that is bringing down in the 80s and 90s an enormous number of people. And you write about it with both admiration and kind of resistance. You don't want to see illness as a metaphor, but you see illness as that precisely.
Yes, that is one of the central challenges in my own experience as a writer, is how does one negotiate that tension? Because certainly the metaphors in the experience of illness are numerous, are myriad. We have, as I described a little bit earlier, patients use metaphoric language all the time to talk about symptoms that really defy any other kind of narration, any other kind of articulation.
Give me an example or two of patients using metaphors to describe what they are going through.
I gave a brief example earlier. I think of people in my own family who come to me for medical advice talking about pain or other kinds of symptoms in ways that are, feels like a cold wind that blows through my breast, or these kinds of almost romantic ways of describing feelings that are really in a kind of tension with, tell me what your pain is on a 1 to 10 scale, and 10 being the worst pain you've ever felt and 1 being very little pain. This is the medical way we try to quantify the unquantifiable. But metaphor somehow allows us to understand what that pain might be like. So those kinds of metaphors are very prevalent. And then, of course, the kinds of metaphors that Sontag talks about, that disease is an expression of our repressed anger or our inability to speak to traumatic experiences. And there are these kinds of superstitions about illness, of course, that also take on a kind of metaphoric meaning, if you will. And so those exist. I certainly don't deny that those are true. And certainly when she speaks about HIV and AIDS, and this was true of my experience as a doctor caring for people with HIV infection early in the course of the epidemic here in the United States, that many patients did feel that this was somehow a punishment of some kind. And those kinds of feelings, I think, are part of how we do as human beings make sense of what seems unthinkable. Our body's betraying us. How does that happen when we don't understand all of the mechanics of the body? So those metaphors are certainly present. And then I think, of course, that the close observation of the experience of illness, that whether it be through the sort of medical lens that does seek to explicate what happens in HIV infection, again, for example, when T cells decline and opportunistic infections can occur, that in itself can also be a kind of deluding fantasy, that somehow by understanding the body's mechanisms that we can fully explicate away the experience of illness, the experience of suffering. So that in and of itself is another kind of problematic story or fantasy. And then, of course, for the writer, the idea of writing about the experience of illness and necessarily using metaphor as a way of accessing that experience and thinking about it in terms of its healing potential, too, that might positive metaphoric constructions actually be helpful. You know, Sontag talks about the negative metaphors that, you know, our repressed anger leads to cancer, our repressed rage leads to other health conditions that are not true about how disease occurs. And yet, I wonder if we can think more positively through metaphor about how our bodies work and how we function. Could those potentially have the opposite effect? Could they be therapeutic?
In the end, poetry is nothing but, I would say, the business of metaphors, of playing with metaphors, and maybe even language itself is nothing but a metaphor. The fact that we use the word phone to describe this object that is in front of me, that arbitrary word that we have all agreed that would define this object, is in itself an abstraction.
Sure, sure. And it's a substitution, just as a way we might describe it in a poem is. And so it's similar, and yet, as you say, is also different.
Right. The inevitable, the essential, the ground zero, again, talking about what a physician and a poet does, is the question of mortality, death, written with a capital D and maybe all of the letters in capitals. There's no way around it. You've been using the word heal. But it's also, I would say, the business of poetry to come to terms with the fact that we're not going to be here in some time, and that whatever is going to be left is the words that we had or the signs or the memories that we managed to, you know, harvest or leave for others. Are you afraid of your own mortality?
No, not at all. And I think because I take such comfort in those words and those ways we are called to these great acts of the imagination in poetry, in art, that sustain us, that are in a way, metaphorically speaking again, a kind of immortality, that we can in some sense defy death by creating these great works of art, these great works of literature that live on after we are no longer here. And as you say, even a word like telephone, even a word like, you know, water, that is a way of reaching back across generations of people who live before us, whose stories are in some sense embedded in those words, that they meant something to us over generations.
And that we carry along and have inherited. But how about the actual moment of death? The moment of the suffering, or the moment of when ourselves will be deteriorating? Are you afraid of that? I understand the larger picture of survival and maybe immortality through something that we have done. But there is that flesh that deteriorates.
Yes, and that is, again, something I've encountered, I've seen in anatomy lab. My first patient was a cadaver that I dissected with some of my fellow medical students. And I remember very clearly in that moment thinking about my own temporariness, my own little time on this earth. And bound up in that recognition of my own mortality was the impulse to make a poem and to speak to that. Not fear, but that acknowledgement of this is a temporary experience, this life that we have. And I think, again, poetry provides just such a wonderful kind of reminder of that in a way that isn't scary, that isn't terrifying, that isn't regretful, that actually is, I think, in many ways, affirming, because it's so deeply human and so, I think, profoundly an expression of who we are as living, breathing beings. Those rhythms of our bodies are present in the language of poetry. And so I find tremendous kind of sustenance in that. And I think that it has helped me not fear when that switch is turned off, so to speak.
You are a very careful writer. You are a patient writer, at least from the perspective of this reader. a writer that over the years has published a small number of collections of poems that in and of themselves are very carefully put together, and that now is at a point with the new unselected poems of looking back and choosing and adding new elements to them. You are also a poet who is very attentive to structure and to received forms, and you play with those forms, the sonnet and others. And just as you were saying that we inherit words from the past and we make those words water or telephone into at least the configuration, something new, You also have inherited the structures from the past and are in a number of ways in dialogue with those that have used them. You've talked to me about the scene in your office with patients. How does an actual poem get to be born? How does it take shape? How painful or not painful is that birth? How many drafts does it go through? When do you feel that the words have finally reached their finished place, the place for which they were meant? And the image that comes to my mind is that if you shook the page and the words came up to the air and then descended, they would descend just where you have put them. What's this process with you?
Well, you know, it's interesting you ask about that, Ilan, because I find that I am a writer who I think is very much engaged with process and not product. And I think that even, you know, this moment of new and selected poems coming out, and I struggled so much with this notion that these poems are being assembled, as you say, in a deliberate way, and they seem to mark a kind of milestone in a writer's, in a poet's career. And yet, I feel that almost everything I've written is as yet unfinished. Perhaps another way of expressing it or explaining it is that they feel like they are continuing to flow out of experiences that I have every day in my office as a doc to this moment. And so even though my poems are very highly structured and I hope more than anything reflect the music of our bodies, the sounds I hear in auscultating our bodies, I don't feel that they are really fully finished products. I imagine them more as connected in some larger sense to this pulsing, larger humanity that we all exist in. And that, again, reaches back through the past, through many generations, and then also into the future. And I hope in some ways will enliven these so-called received forms in ways for poets of the future to engage and to respond to. And so I experience them, I think, more in that kind of living kind of corpus sense. And yet I did struggle with putting them together in this format. And then in terms of the writing process itself, I find that my writing takes shape in the context of these relationships with my patients. And so they feel to me often like, this is probably not a great metaphor, but stones that are polished by the flow of water over them, the ongoing stories, the ongoing narratives of my patients that really shape them, that really give them form. But yet, again, don't ever feel completely finished. And so the process for me is a very, I think, organic one, an elemental one. And I don't sit down with the intent of I'm going to write a sonnet. But yet something in the experience of what I'm addressing calls me to that form, perhaps because of that archaeology of the sonnet, that, you know, there's something about love or trying to express love in a constrained space, which is one of the challenges, I think, of being a doctor, too. How do we express our love for our patients, which is a real feeling that I think certainly I've experienced in caring for patients.
In this organic, in the, if I understand it, open, unfinished approach that you have to poetry, are you also telling me that when a poem has already been published, say, in a magazine or in a collection, but is now being recollected, there is not only the temptation, but maybe the intervention of rewriting it, of changing aspects of it, or Once it's published, it's fixed?
That is a temptation. And, you know, I think of it both in terms of my relation to Spanish and to translation. To my mind, you know, these are always processes that defy a kind of finishedness, that defines a kind of this is done statement. And so partly because I write from a place that is also Spanish, but is not explicitly Spanish, That may be another reason why they don't ever feel fully finished. And so, yes, I oftentimes do feel that there's a kind of invitation there to revise them. Might I rewrite this in Spanish? Might I rewrite it entirely in the language
of... But you don't act on it?
I will confess I do. I do. I have that fantasy. And I do that. And I haven't published anything in Spanish because, I mean, there also is this kind of funny paradox, too, about, you know, the act of publishing as a way to create an ending, to create, you know, I'm done with this, even though... It will never be done, but it kind of provides that impression, perhaps, that I've reached enough of a...
Have you surrendered?
Yes, it's more of a surrender. Thank you. That's exactly the word I was looking for.
So yeah. Why haven't you published the ones in Spanish? Am I thinking here that there is a control or familiarity with the English language? I'm just speculating. Mm. That is not with the Spanish language. As I know from your biography, it's a language that dates back to your past, but that has... because of your medical profession and the poetry that you write, is maybe together with English, but in a together side, or because you would feel that they wouldn't require more work?
Wonderful. I have a couple of responses, I guess. One is that Spanish is still very much bound up in shame for me and a kind of injury that in some ways actually inspired me to become a doctor and to become a poet, to try to heal this wound of the immigrant experience coming to this country and the trauma of having lost everything in Cuba that my family experienced, not me personally, but that was certainly something that was in many ways inflicted on me through the stories that I was told growing up. And some of those stories, loving and caring and salvaging as they, I think, in some ways were intended, were also painful and wounding. And I remember my grandparents saying to me, you know, don't try to speak Spanish. Your Spanish is ugly. And yet there was this sense, too, that Spanish was a tie, a connection to this lost experience, this island that we could never return to. And so I think that's part of why writing in Spanish still is such a conundrum for me, is such a problem, because I want so much to retrace that journey, to heal that wound, and somehow to do so through writing in Spanish seems like perhaps the way I might actually do that. And yet that wound is irreparable. It's a fracture that can never be repaired. And so I don't have that tool to fix it. And so, yeah, I think that it's shaming for me in some ways to think about writing in Spanish because of that history.
We're coming to the conclusion of the episode. You mentioned the island that you and the ancestors cannot go back to. The word utopia means there is no such place. And of course, every birth is being thrown out of that island that we cannot go back to. And our life is nothing, perhaps, than a longing for that return. I want you to react to that famous line. I believe it's by W.H. Auden that poetry makes nothing happen. It seems that it does to you. But once the poem is out and it's no longer in your hands, once you are a name on the cover or a sheer reference that the reader might or might not even remember, because good poems are beyond their authors, will poetry make something happen?
I think so, Ilan, in perhaps the most sort of practical and unartistic ways. I've seen how poetry can console someone who is grieving. I've experienced that in caring for my patients. I can see how sharing a poem has taken away someone's pain, even if just for a moment, perhaps by simply distracting them, perhaps by elevating their consciences to a place beyond where that pain exists. And so I think that poetry does make things happen. And in my own life, I think, yes, I find that poetry has made it possible for me to be a much more effective healer and to really join with my patients in these experiences of suffering that I think, yes, perhaps in that longer worldview are in some ways insignificant, but in that moment are the most important thing that we could be doing. So that's, again, perhaps in some ways a kind of a naive view of what poetry can do, but that's been my
work. But maybe being naive is the way to go about it.
Yes, yes, especially medicine.
It's been an enormous pleasure having you in Contrast. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Ilan. That was a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. In Hamlet, the Prince of Denmark says to Horatio, just follow the logic. Alexander died. Alexander was buried, Alexander returned to dust, the dust is dirt, and dirt makes mud we use to stop holes. So why can't someone plug a beer barrel with the dirt that used to be Alexander? The great Emperor Caesar, dead and turned to clay, might plug up a hole to keep the wind away. Oh, to think that the same body that once ruled the world could now patch up a wall. But quiet, be quiet a minute. This is an image of how life and death are linked, how everything that we are, that we do, returns to the source. Doctors see these cycles up close. They witness the arrival of life and also see its conclusion. They do what's possible to prolong life, sometimes furiously and incautiously. They understand that what's living today will not be around tomorrow, but new entities will emerge to replace what's gone. There is sadness in this realization, and there can also be compassion. Few, however, would describe themselves as artists. Yet artists they can be in making life more malleable, more enduring. William Carlos Williams, the poet of Paterson, New Jersey, said, "All writing is a disease. You can't stop it." I'm not sure I would describe writing as a disease, but it can be obsessive. It is also a way to build bridges, to engage with others. Writing isn't a profession. It isn't a task. Instead, it is a need. It comes from the heart and from the mind and from the spirit. To write is to make oneself present, to be alive. To write is also to defy death. Hamlet is right. We are dirt, but dirt that vibrates until it doesn't. It is crucial to leave an account of those vibrations, to explain how to defy stillness. Next time on In Contrast.
Women's lives have been difficult for all of human history. It's not like I invented that. It's not like Trump invented that. It's not like that didn't just happen recently. It's always been bad. And I think that my book is a reflection of this is what it looks like when you don't see yourself anywhere and you need to put yourself everywhere.
Carmen Maria Machado on the next In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our interns include Delina Hatku and Jacob Pagano. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.